Welcome, everyone, to Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific? Jim Caruso, I am still in California.
I'm still in New York, Ray.
Well, today we have another Californian on the line, or at least for now he's a Californian. Arzan Tarapur has been a resident of a couple of different countries. I first met him in Australia, I believe on a visit. He is now a research scholar at the Center for International Security and Cooperation at Stanford, which of course is where I do a lot of my work. And his research focuses on India and Indian regional security issues. He previously worked, telegraphing our disdain for academia. We're letting him on because he previously worked as a practitioner for 13 years in the Australian Defense Department. And Arzan, just so you know, our disdain is only because we don't have any of those degrees ourselves.
Well, thanks, Ray. I have a fair degree of self-loathing myself, so we're all in good company.
Well, then you're part of the club. That's good.
Well, we're happy to be able to do another India episode. Our previous India episode has got something like 30,000 views on YouTube. So it's India is a great place to spread the word about our podcast and our work. And so and it's a great place for us to sort of expand our horizons because neither of us were really India hands at all during our time in service. But you have recently been doing some work specifically on the question of India's Navy. And so we're going to ask you our usual question, which is the why should we care question. Why should we care if India seems to be deprioritizing investments in its Navy?
Yeah, big question, Ray. Thanks first of all for having me on. I really like the title of your podcast and therefore the mission of your podcast. So I'm a big believer in what you're doing. So thanks for having me on, and thanks for making sure that India is part of the Indo-Pacific. So first of all, kudos. And secondly, to answer that question, it part of the answer to that is because we are talking about the Indo-Pacific, and India, as successive U.S. administrations have said, is an anchor of U.S. policy in the region. It is, in fact, an anchor of the Indo-Pacific, right? When we think about the Indo-Pacific, I think of that, and I know different people have different views, I think of it as two big oceans and their littorals. And so if you are concerned about the Indo-Pacific, then you have to be concerned about India and its role in the Indian Ocean region, and therefore its role as one of the key players in the whole larger region of the Indo-Pacific. Now, we can get into the Navy issue, but essentially India acts in the region across the Indian Ocean region primarily through its ability in military terms to project force across the water. And so therefore, whatever happens to the Indian Navy happens to the Indian Ocean, and whatever happens to the Indian Ocean happens to the Indo-Pacific.
I guess the question for us is, we've been trying as Americans and Australians to bring India closer into our grouping for security purposes. And while the Quad is not a security entity, whatever it is, it is a means to try and bring them closer to us. How does this comport with India's self-image as still a leader of non-aligned movement?
So I think, first of all, non-aligned has been sort of overtaken by a gentler version of a similar idea, which is essentially strategic autonomy, right? And I think in today's India, the way that idea is most often or most compellingly expressed is India as being one of the poles of a multipolar world. I think that is the way that the current government of India sees its role in the world as one of the poles in a multipolar system. And so they would probably take exception to the idea that the US and Australia are the point to which India is being drawn, right? Because from their point of view, they are an independent and powerful actor in the world, as is the United States. And the two countries, the US and India, have a certain degree of overlapping interests, but also a certain degree of policy divergences, like any two countries would. And so while the US and Australia are treaty allies and have been historically very close, very deep and broad relationship. The relationship with India is newer, less deep, less broad, but very important because it is a very big and powerful country. And so the issue is not about bringing India in, right? Because that's the sort of mentality of the US leading a bloc. That's not the correct framing here. The correct framing is there are several countries that matter, that shape the Indo-Pacific, and the United States and India are two of the most important countries in the region, and to the extent that they have overlapping national security interests, it behooves them, as well as other middle powers like Australia, to work more closely together. And so that's where a lot of my research lies, in trying to understand what are India's interests, what are those overlaps, what are those divergences, and how can we all work as best as we can together to maintain, as the governments would call it, a free and open Indo-Pacific.
So from an India layman's perspective, I would perceive, so India has a lot of overlapping interests with the United States vis-a-vis its northern neighbor China, right? To some degree, China is maybe even almost overtaking Pakistan as India's chief, you know, security concern.
Yep.
Whereas we have very divergent interests when it comes to other major nations on the U.S. Radar, if you will, Russia and Iran.
Yep.
So, you know, how, so then if we are able to say, you know, is it possible for the U.S. or in Australia to sort of separate those two things out when it comes to dealing like with a problem like the Indian Ocean?
Yeah. So first of all, your characterization is correct, is spot on. And in fact, from the Indian point of view, they've been dealing with China as a sort of adversary with varying levels of intensity for longer than the US has, right? So from the Indian point of view, which fought a war against China in 1962 on their common border, which has been disputed ever since, China has always been something of an adversary to greater or lesser extents. And in 2020, when there was a major border crisis begun, since then, that security competition between India and China has intensified. But it's always been there to a degree. And from the Indian point of view, don't forget it was the United States that in the post-Cold War decades considered China to be sort of winnable, to be integratable into the international system as a responsible power. And so from the Indian point of view, it was the United States that built up China as an adversary. And so they have recognized from their point of view for a longer time the true nature of China as a security challenge to be dealt with.
So how does the Navy fit into meeting this challenge?
Yeah, very good question, because And so the way Ray originally characterized it as India's northern neighbor is correct, obviously. Geography is immutable. But whereas I think for decades it was largely a northern neighbor issue, a continental border issue, the reality that confronts India today for the last few years and certainly for the foreseeable future is that China is not only a challenge on the northern border. It is a comprehensive security challenge for India, meaning comprehensive, meaning geographically. It is a 360-degree challenge. It's on the northern border. It's a close ally with Pakistan, India's other major rival. And as I make clear in some recent research, it is building a capability for a persistent presence in the Indian Ocean, right? So it in one form or another, either directly or through an ally or through power projection across the waters, is going to have the ability to essentially surround India. And I might add, it's not just geographic, it's also across domains, right? As everyone understands, China's increasing presence and capabilities in the space and cyber domains are also inescapable for India. So the thing that has changed the most, I think, in the last decade for India is that China is not just, it's not just the quantum of power that China has. It's the other dimensions that China has now gained a presence, be they geographic dimensions or different domains. And that makes the China challenge for India unprecedentedly comprehensive. And to bring it back to your question, the Navy, the Indian Navy, the naval competition, the maritime domain in the Indian Ocean is one of the geographic theaters and domains that takes a long time to affect change in. It takes a long time to build naval capabilities. And my concern is that China's power is increasing so quickly that it will be impossible for India to catch up to China in the Indian Ocean. Right now, there is a sort of seductive sense that India has advantages and indeed dominance in the Indian Ocean, and it does. But that's just a snapshot. If you think in terms of dynamic realities, if you think in terms of trends, then very, very quickly, China is going to be able to sustain a persistent presence in the Indian Ocean in a way that's going to challenge India's national interests like they've never been challenged before. And by the time that becomes a reality, by the time we can take that snapshot and see the Chinese challenge, it's going to be too late to correct it.
So for people who do security a lot, like us, like people on this call, we always think that we should prioritize a lot of things, right? We should push a lot of priorities up to the top. And basically we think that, you know, that needs not just to be a bigger slice of the pie, but there needs to be a bigger pie for security. And, you know, so in the US, that conversation sounds a lot like, well, how do we do the Europe and the Middle East while also addressing the China challenge, you know, those kinds of discussions. In India, and I've had a chance to thank you for sending us your draft research. I've kind of had a chance to absorb your ideas here. You know, we've got this situation along what we call a line of actual control, or basically the border with China, that has been intensifying, especially in the last 4 years or so, that you argue is drawing resources away from the Navy. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. So we have to be careful how we characterize it, because in the Indian security ecosystem, the army has always been clearly far and away the dominant military service as compared with the Air Force and Navy. And that's because continental threats have always been the dominant threats as compared with anything else. So India has fought 5 wars on its borders, right? It's India tomorrow, on August the 15th, turns 77. And sorry, I'm just trying to make sure my maths is correct. And in that time, it's fought 5 wars on its northern borders against Pakistan and China. So its borders are unsettled, and that has always been the vector from which threats to the Indian homeland have come. And so therefore, it's logical, it makes sense, it's understandable why the army has always had such an outsized role. But my argument in this research and previously as well has been that the international system is changing, and that India's neighborhood is changing, and the array of threats that India faces has been changing. You are absolutely right, Ray, that, you know, whenever you read a national security strategy from the US, it says that everything is priority number one, and that's problematic. And it is a tough problem to say what will you prioritize at the cost of what. And my argument is that there has always been this imbalance towards continental threats and an imbalance towards resourcing the army adequately. My argument has been that it is time to rebalance that allocation of resources. And I think and I've compiled some of this research that in the previous, in the first two decades of this century, for argument's sake, if you take as a starting point the year 2000, and if you take the two decades between 2000 and 2020, when the Ladakh border crisis began, you saw a significant degree of Indian investment in the Navy, capability development, right? So long-term investment in capability. So we're not talking about exercises, we're not talking about operations, we're talking about building capability for the future. We saw a fair degree of action on that in between 2000 and 2020. And my interpretation of that is that the Indian system understood that its threats were changing, that it was going to face a greater need to act more assertively in the Indian Ocean. But come 2020, with the Ladakh border crisis, where China launched multiple near simultaneous incursions across the LAC, and that border crisis has not been fully resolved, it's only been partially managed since then, the result of that is that India has had to redouble its military presence on the northern border, and also redouble essentially the effort and political attention that it gives to the continental threat posed by China, at the expense, as you correctly note, resources and attention are finite. So therefore, if you redouble your resources and attention for that threat, it comes at the expense of long-term capability development for the Navy, and it comes at the expense of India's future posture in the Indian Ocean. Again, because we're talking about investments for the future here, and so while the snapshot of the current system does not suggest that India is losing ground in the Indian Ocean, I think there are leading indicators that suggest that in the future, the military balance will shift in the Indian Ocean to China's advantage and to India's disadvantage. And so the time to reallocate resources, the time to reprioritize is now.
So the US, Australia, Philippines, South Korea, Japan have all made the same analysis. I have different immediate circumstances, but all of you, the pacing threat from China has increased. And therefore, further cooperation and tightening of the alliances was absolutely necessary. Yes. To the point now we have AUKUS and the sharing of most critical U.S. technology with Australia to develop submarines. Now, India faces this problem, but has, as you said, a very proud tradition of being totally sovereign, which, as George Washington would say, no entangling alliances. So how do they meet the challenge in their way without getting closer to the U.S. and others? Can they do that?
Not without getting closer to the U.S. and others, right? And so the argument that I make in this paper that will soon come out is that no one, this is not a problem particular to India, but no one can match China's ability to produce stuff to invest in future capability. And so the only way to meet the challenge is to find some sort of offset. And so if you cannot build mass, naval mass, and India cannot keep up, the US and Australia cannot keep up, you know, pound for pound building mass, then the only way to meet that challenge is through the offsets presented by cooperation, right? And integration to varying degrees. Now, of course, India is not an ally of the United States, so we're not going to see the level of cooperation that we see, excuse me, between the US and Australia. We're not going to see an AUKUS style relationship. We're not going to see a Five Eyes style relationship. But what we will see, what we've already seen significantly, is a closer relationship. And I think there are ways that the relationship can continue to get closer. And I think the Indian government recognizes that the only way that it can build national power is through greater cooperation with the United States and other countries, right? It's not just the US, it's also countries like France, Israel, Japan, et cetera, Australia. And so it's only through those connections that India can build the national power that it requires. But of course, that's going to be short of an ANZUS-style alliance. It's going to be short of an AUKUS-style collaboration. But there are still many things that remain to be done that would benefit India and that would benefit other like-minded countries.
So getting specific, you talk in your paper about the need to develop in specifically undersea capabilities, undersea domain awareness, and submarines, undersea autonomous vehicles, these kinds of things. Why are you so focused on undersea capabilities?
So again, this is a matter of prioritization, right? If you're going to, in my analysis, if you are going to meet the threat, you have to do the thing that achieves the greatest bang for your buck. My analysis leads me to that conclusion because what I see is that the Chinese Navy is building a presence that will give it, in the very near future, a robust sea denial capability in the Indian Ocean, primarily through undersea warfare, primarily through, increased submarine and UUV operations in the Indian Ocean. And so, to my mind, that poses the biggest security threat to India, Australia, and the United States in the Indian Ocean. So to meet that threat, or that risk, I should say, India, the US, and Australia, if they are to prioritize their cooperation, should prioritize ASW, anti-submarine warfare, and undersea warfare investments and activities. Now, again, like I said, it comes back to your ability to build mass. And I don't think, as we've seen with the sort of hand-wringing around AUKUS, I don't think there is a lot of excess capacity to build a lot more submarines. So if you can't build a lot more submarines, what can you do? You can increase cooperation. And through cooperation itself, there are advantages to be gained, operational advantages to be gained, whereby countries like India, Australia, and the US, but not only them, also other interested countries like the UK, France, Japan, could participate to do things like share undersea domain awareness data, to coordinate ASW operations, if it comes to that, and to co-develop relatively cheaper technologies like UUVs or sensors to put on UUVs, or even software that helps using AI to understand the data that gets collected by these sensors on these UUVs. So there's many different levels of cooperation that like-minded countries could pursue. But my point is that the thing these countries need to do, the way to meet this challenge most effectively, is to find relatively cheap and relatively quick actions, right? So not building submarines that will take 20, 30, 40 years to launch, but doing things that are relatively quicker to be fielded and relatively cheaper. Because again, the root of the problem is that we do not collectively do not have the resources to match the PLA Navy pound for pound. So we need to find the offsets. And my argument is that the offsets are to be found through cooperation.
Does India have the defense industrial capability to do what you're suggesting?
Yes, in short, because again, this is not about, this is where this is, the recommendations that I advance in this paper are not centered around, do not require massive defense industrial capacity, right? The recommendations that I am suggesting require instead something that may be an equally scarce supply, which is political will to cooperate, to share data, to coordinate operations, and for example, innovation ecosystems, R&D networks that can collaborate across national borders, right? So the issue is not about defense industrial capacity. Of course, that's an issue, and of course, increased defense industrial capacity would address many problems. But the recommendations that I'm making in this paper get around that problem. They suggest that there are other things that countries like India and the US and Australia can do. If we can, for example, more effectively collaborate on innovation on UUVs and their sensors. So, you know, there's a by now classic example of Anduril and Australian corporate partners building an extra large UUV. And that is the sort of transnational collaboration that I'm talking about, which doesn't require huge numbers of shipyards churning out huge numbers of heavy ships. It requires smart people being able to share ideas and develop niche technologies that can have an outsized strategic effect.
I'm going to draw us back a little bit to the geography. And for those of us who don't spend as much time on Indian Ocean issues, you know, we tend to think of certain places a lot, right? So let's go to the west. You have the Strait of Hormuz with the Persian Gulf and the Red Sea over there. And then way over on the east, you have the Strait of Malacca with the South China Sea over there. And then in the middle, there's just all this water, right? You know, and it sort of goes by this big, but we don't really talk about all of that water very much. And yet in your paper, you talk about India having sort of this idea that it can exercise sea control over its Indian Ocean approaches, and yet this threat that China be able to exercise sea denial over those. If China is successful in being able to deny India the ability to access those sea lines of communication, as we call them, what would be the effect on India if they were denied use of those sea routes?
So any my friends who wear white suits will always remind me first and foremost that any sea control or sea denial is bounded in time and space, right? There is no sort of oceanic sea control. There is no oceanic sea denial, right? The idea is that at a certain time, at a certain place, you are able to either control or deny traffic through the water. And so the issue is, again, not that in the foreseeable future, China will be able to blockade India so that no trade goes in or out. The issue is more that it will be able to sustain essentially a force in being, a fleet in being, that need not be very large. That can be a small number of submarines, for example, that could pose enough of a threat to disrupt Indian shipping, be it military or commercial or energy, and disrupt, for example, the sustainment and resupply of the Andaman and Nicobar Islands, right? Offshore islands that are part of Indian territory, for example. And so, the idea of sea denial is not that India will be cut off from international trade, but that international commerce, energy supplies, or military operations will be disrupted. And even the smallest disruptions, as we've seen with accidents in the Suez, for example, even the smallest disruptions can have surprisingly large cascading effects. And so when a country like India is so dependent on sea, on access to the sea for trade and energy and military freedom of action, and the same and to a slightly lesser extent, the same is true of Australia's access to the Indian Ocean, then even relatively minor disruptions can have an outsized effect. And so that, to me, is the issue. As you said, Ray, you know, historical thinkers about the Indian Ocean have long identified certain choke points, access points to the Indian Ocean, as being key terrain, so to speak, maritime terrain of the Indian Ocean. And so, you know, bottling up the Indian Ocean at those choke points, at the narrow seas, can have a disproportionate effect, which is why the Indian Ocean maintains deployments around those choke points. But the problem is not that you can sort of seal off India. The problem is that you can just cause enough of a disruption that it has a major strategic effect on any country like India.
I'm going to pull back a little further and take advantage of your Australian accent and note that your former Prime Minister Keating said the other day that basically we are way overblowing the threat from China. We're overreacting. And by the way, Taiwan is Chinese territory. And we're just wasting our time. Is this a view also common in India by any chance, or is there a more united front on this?
I don't think it's a view that's very common anywhere. I mean, whatever you think of Paul Keating's tenure as prime minister, 30 years ago, a generation ago, I don't want to speculate, but I would just simply argue that the views that he consistently propounds do not match reality. They are overtaken by events.
They don't match Nancy Pelosi's either, in case you hadn't heard recently.
Exactly. It's a shame that in any country a small number of voices can have an outsized impact on the debate. But anyway, sorry, getting back to your question, Jim. Look, it's a minority view in Australia, and I think it's a minority view in India as well. Earlier in our conversation, Ray mentioned something about China overtaking Pakistan as India's primary security concern, and I think that has been the case for some time, right? At an intellectual level, the Indian security establishment has for quite some time recognized China as being their pacing threat. Now, resource allocation, military organization, et cetera, are all pretty sticky. So it takes, they are lagging indicators. It will take some time for those material manifestations to catch up to this understanding of China. But I think India, the consensus view in India certainly is that China is their pacing threat, just as it is for the US and Australia. And that's certainly been underscored since the beginning of the Ladakh crisis in 2020. If anything, what that did was it shrank the space for any dissent to that view. It made that view so difficult to argue with that those voices that in India may have previously given some more benefit of the doubt to China no longer carry any water. And so the question now is, okay, China is the pacing threat. What do we do about it? What about China is the most important thing? And that's the sort of debate that I am engaging with in my recent research.
One thing that has changed in recent years in the maritime space is Australia finally being able to, having pounded on the door for a long time, finally being able to get into the Malabar exercises, basically making it actually a quad exercise. The US, Japan, and India had been doing this exercise for many years, and for various reasons, Australia was not quite able to find its way in. What do you think was the factor that finally made this possible so that Australia is now part of Malabar?
So I'm obligated to say before I begin the actual answer that we should remember that it is a exercise between the four quad countries, but it is not a quad activity, right?
Yes, sir.
It is part of what I have called what I if you'll sort of indulge the academic side of me, it's what I have called the informal quad, right? The four quad countries doing stuff together, but not being officially under the quad itself. To answer your question, I think two factors have produced this, and they interact. These are two factors that interact. One is exactly what I just said in the previous answer, which is a growing consensus and a growing urgency in India about the threat that China poses. And so there is a growing urgency to do something about it. And Malabar is one of those things. The Quad is one of those things that India is doing about it. And the other related factor is the growing level of trust bilaterally between India and Australia. Decades ago, I think there was a significant degree of distrust from India towards Australia. And I think in recent years, a very sort of workmanlike, sort of steady progress has been made in that bilateral relationship. And a lot of credit is due to militaries and public services of the two countries to not give up on that. And that has essentially laid the foundation and allowed the two countries' political leaderships to take a little bit more political risk and to do things like readmit Australia into Malabar. And it's not just Malabar, right? It's also Indians participating in other military exercises hosted in Australia, for example. So I would suggest it is both a growing urgency to deal with the challenges posed by China and that important trust building, what the Quad bureaucrats would call habits of cooperation. That have enabled more headline activities like Malabar to happen.
So we were discussing before you joined us the difficulty the U.S. may have in the future with India if the Prime Minister keeps going off to Russia to give bear hugs to Putin. And you're in the U.S. now. How do you see the U.S. managing this situation?
So first, let's not forget that Modi went to Moscow, and that visit to Moscow was sandwiched between Modi giving a bear hug first to Zelensky before he went to Moscow, and press reporting suggests that in a week or so he will go to Kyiv. So from the Indian point of view, this is, an example of very concerted, determined strategic autonomy, right? Because from India's point of view, there are very strong interests at stake in maintaining that relationship with Russia. It's a very old relationship, and it's a relationship on which India depends very critically. To their credit, I think the Biden administration has recognized that India cannot turn on a dime. It cannot remake its political relationships. It cannot remake its military dependencies. It cannot remake its thirst for energy, right? It is a developing country. It is a developing country where the military depends critically on Russian supplies for spare parts and maintenance. So it cannot, even if it wanted to, it could not break the relationship with Russia. And it doesn't want to. Why would it? Because Russia is another one of the poles in the multipolar system. So it needs to maintain a productive relationship with Russia, or at least a non-tense relationship with Russia. And to their credit, it seems that even though India's quote-unquote neutrality over the Ukraine war has been irksome, has been annoying to the US, the Biden administration has dealt with it pretty maturely. The US has dealt with it pretty maturely. It understands the bind that New Delhi is in, and it is not pressing New Delhi too much. I think there are enough signs coming out of New Delhi that it is not comfortable with the degree of dependency that it has on Russia. It wishes it was not as dependent on Russia as it is, but it cannot escape those binds, right? The military and energy dependencies that it has. And so, and the US understands that. The issue is, okay, how do we from an Indian perspective, navigate that relationship? Everything in international relations is path dependent, right? You can't sort of wish away history. And so so what India is trying to do is demonstrate that this is not a relationship that it wants at the expense of other relationships, including its relationship with Ukraine, on which it also depends to a lesser degree. It is not a relationship it wishes to break because, again, coming back to geography, it has a intense security rivalry with China. It would make no sense for India to provoke security rivalries with the other major power of the Eurasian continent or with one of the major powers of the Middle East in Iran. It behooves India to maintain at least non-threatening, if not productive, relationships with all of these countries. And that's the perspective that it takes. And I think the understanding of India is now mature enough in the US that they recognize that there are limits to how quickly India will distance itself from Russia or Iran and will just do what is possible.
Well, Arzan, this has been really fascinating. We need to get you out on a lighter note. So you've had enough time now in the Bay Area to shake free from some of your archaic Australian League football loyalties or rugby league or whatever it was that you did there. You've been around a little while, so I'm going to give you four choices, okay, and you can pick your favorite. Golden State Warriors, San Francisco 49ers, San Francisco Giants, or pick your favorite Stanford athletic event.
Or it doesn't have to be in the Bay Area.
What?
Excuse me. Yeah. You can be expansive.
Yankees can just kind of quiet down over there, all right? We're talking about, you know, local.
I didn't name a team, America's team.
Well, look, especially after just what just happened in the Olympics, I think I'd be remiss if I didn't pick the Golden State Warriors and their star performers of the last week or so.
I thought you were going to mention the 27 medals that Stanford athletes won in the Olympics.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
It was an incredible number.
That's right. Bigger than many countries. Almost. Yeah,
certainly more than New York.
Yeah.
Whatever universities they have in that other place.
Yeah, we have academic scholarships here.
That's right.
Yeah. What do you and I know about that, Jim?
That's right. For people who have not physically traveled these roads on the edge of campus, I don't know if it's still there, but last year certainly there used to be this big sign on the edge of Stanford's campus lauding some Stanford athletic team. I think it was women's gymnastics or something, in big letters and big, you know, faces of the athletes, and almost as an afterthought or a postscript down the bottom. And it said, oh yeah, and also Stanford's Nobel laureates.
You know where our bread is buttered.
What do they play?
Exactly. All right, Arzan, this has been fantastic. I really appreciate you joining us. We're definitely going to have to do this again.
Thanks very much, guys. Appreciate it. And thanks for spreading the good word.
So, Ray, every time we talk about India, I'm reminded that a country of 1.4 billion people with this long history and a very proud tradition of political activism and international leadership is a complicated place at the best of times. And for us to try and understand it as outsiders is really tough.
Yeah. And I think, as I said, you know, you and I, neither one of us sort of grew up in the South Asia environment. We were a little further to the east. And so I always feel like I'm coming from behind the curve. And yet the issues there are so large and so pressing. And it really, honestly, even in our national conversation, it may be one of the last places on earth that we talk about in any way commensurate with its size and importance.
It's really true. I always fear that they almost overestimate their capabilities because they are individually very capable. They're huge. They have a growing economy. But are they, like they say of Brazil, the country of the future and always will be? Are they able to get organized enough to really influence things the way they probably should?
Yeah. And so, you know, to sort of zone in on what we were talking about today, the Indian Ocean, I mean, the whole reason that the Indo-Pacific arose as a term and thus the name of our podcast, and also the Indo-Pacific Command, for which you once worked. I mean, it didn't used to be called that. It was called Pacific Command forever and ever and ever. And, you know, I was one who was annoyed by the change because, you know, Indo-PACOM is such a longer acronym than PACOM. But it was this recognition that there's just this massive part of the world that we just sort of didn't account for in our lexicon, right? And even though Pacific Command was sort of responsible for all of that space, just by in just sort of not bringing in the Indian Ocean into the just the name, I think it was really actually a very significant renaming, as annoyed as I was when it happened.
Well, I'm glad you're over it, Ray.
Not quite. Yeah, I'm still a prisoner to my, as most of us, you know, everything was easier and better when I was younger and we did things the right way. And the way that these kids like our producer Ian do things today, that's too modern and too out of touch with our history and traditions. So yes, I'm getting to be an old crotchety old man very quickly.
I like how you say getting to be, but all right.
All right. Well, so Jim, you got to tell us a story today. What's on your mind?
Well, since we were talking about athletic prowess at the end, it takes me back to my first tour in Santo Domingo, Dominican Republic, where they, of course, have some of the best baseball players in the world. And I was in the visa section. And every year, the Dominican players would come in with their agents and apply for their work visas to work in the U.S., often with their wives. And at least one very famous Dominican ball player would come in every year with a new wife. And we questioned how he could have so many wives. And we were told he's a very good baseball player. So that's one. Two, they have the Winter League there, right? And baseball games in the Dominican Republic are a different affair. First of all, between innings, they have go-go girls on top of the dugouts dancing in skippy little outfits. They sell cigars.
Does this happen at Yankees games?
Only ad hoc. Huh. They sell cigars and little bottles of rum from the vendors. So the games are very exciting. And sometimes out in the parking lot, they have chicken fights, cock fights. So that was fun.
We used to have Crazy George.
or the San Diego Chicken. This is different. But the best was we had that embassy softball team, and we were challenged once by the Dominican Air Force team. Now, Dominican Air Force isn't very big, right? And we figured, well, we'll at least give them a game. So these guys go out there. The pitcher has a beer behind him as he's pitching, has a cigar in one hand. These guys pounded us mercilessly. They were so good. They were so good.
And yeah, but their ice hockey team sucks.
I don't know. Maybe. So anyway, they are just the most amazing athletes I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And have a hell of a good time being that way.
Well, that's amazing. You know, that's one reason I love this segment is we get to just sit back and think of when you get to spend a few decades in the foreign service or the military service, you just get to go to some amazing places and see some amazing things. And it really does change your view on the world. But
it's true.
Yeah. So that is that's it for this week. I think we are done recording for this week. I am about to get back on another plane back to Manila again. So it seems to be a regular part of my life now. But I still enjoy going out to see these places. So anyway, until next time, I'm Ray and this is Jim. And to our producer, Ian, a shout out. Thanks for joining us. And why should we care about the Indo-Pacific?